This is 89.9 WWNO. Yes, we're headed for another art-filled week. Are you making plans or do you need some ideas? Well, you've come to the right place. Whether you're in the mood for a rare exhibit of artworks by a French modernist or conversation with a Grammy-winning jazz vocalist and songwriter, it's all in the mixed media. Come along as we go inside the arts. Hi, I'm your host, Diane Mack. An exhibition of artworks by famed French modernist Françoise Gillot are on view in New Orleans. Rare monotypes plus drawings and oil paintings by the artist, once a muse to Picasso, are being shown in the exhibit Monotypes, Cartography of Hidden Worlds, presented by the Mack Grider Gallery in the city's Arts District. Gallery co-founders Jill Magawi and Garland Grider are here. Welcome to Inside the Arts.
Hello.
How you doing?
The artwork and the storied life of Françoise Gillot is fascinating. The artist, now in her late 90s, continues to express herself in creative ways, with monotypes being a focus in her later years. This must be very exciting for you, as your gallery is fairly new in the Arts District. How did this come about?
This is Jill. We're carrying over a relationship with Françoise Gillot from a French Quarter gallery that existed for 45 years, the Vincent Mann Gallery, where she showed until its founder's death in 2017. So we're actually her second gallery in New Orleans in all of these years.
The exhibit, Monotypes, is subtitled Cartography of Hidden Worlds. What are these hidden worlds viewers will see and experience?
This is Garland. They're so interesting because a monotype is a one-of-one. It's a one-of-a-kind print. So she's painting essentially on a piece of plexiglass and then making the print onto the paper. And that's how it's usually done, but Françoise has taken it to the next level. So she has collaged the different monotypes that she's made into other compositions, and then she's painted on top of them, reprinted on top of them with various inks. You know, she does a Chinlay Collet technique, which is like you put a paste or a paint on the plexiglass and then you put like little tissue paper or Japanese paper that's very thin and then put a regular sheet of paper behind it to back, so that goes on the paper as well as the ink or the paint on the stone.
So they're very layered, very elaborate. Some are abstract compositions, others have figurative elements, and the colors are luminous, and there's a lot of movement and texture. They're very joyful, quite a synthesis of what she does in her oil paintings and what she does in other types of mediums.
And they're so complex as well. You know, like every time you look at them, you see something different.
They actually fit in to her body of work. They relate to early studies in printmaking that she did as a young adult, and she does them concurrently. So she'll be in the studio working on oils for a period of time, then she'll switch gears and go into the studio to do monotypes, and then she'll go back to her drawing studio and do a series of drawings. So they're not separate and apart from, they're another language within which she works.
Which keeps her current.
Absolutely. She's using a lot of different techniques. You know, she's printing monotypes, but also with the monotypes, she's cutting out squares or shapes or whatever of the different monotypes and making new compositions on top of other monotypes and then collaging on top of that and then painting on top of that, then rerunning it through the print again. It's amazing. It's very, very innovative.
Françoise is never content to do things the simple, easy way. She's always interested in pushing the envelope, seeing what the techniques can give her, what the materials can give her, and you see that very strongly in the monotypes. They are complex, they're very labor-intensive, and they take a lot of time. It's a metaphor for our own inner landscapes. We are all multifaceted people. So she's showing us a way to map our own inner worlds through these monotypes. She has a tremendous intelligence, and she brings that to bear in her artworks, drawing on her first baccalaureate degree, which had a concentration in philosophy. She also has an English degree from Cambridge University, and she went all the way through the law school curriculum at her father's insistence. So she has many levels of reference, including the Greek canon. And as a female artist connected to a titan in the modern art world who had a very strong personality, she often had to hide her brilliance.
The titan you refer to is none other than Pablo Picasso.
Absolutely.
She was his muse for a while.
11 years.
They met early on in the war during the German occupation of Paris.
1941.
And he found her captivating. She was beautiful. She was challenging. She wasn't cowed by his strength of personality. And she invited him to go see her first exhibition, which he did. And he left a note in the guest book saying, "You are very gifted for drawing. You should come to my studio and I'll show you my Matisse," which I think is the best pickup line ever.
Absolutely.
So she waited an appropriate interval, didn't want to seem too eager, and she went. And he wooed her and pursued her, and they had a meeting of the minds. And I think he also viewed her as the ultimate challenge because she wasn't going to give in easily.
Right. I mean, and Picasso has famously said women are either goddesses or doormats. So you can just draw from that.
She wasn't a doormat.
Absolutely not. Absolutely.
She was the only woman to leave Picasso.
She was. And all the rest of the women, you know, unfortunately, either went insane or, you know, committed suicide.
He didn't believe she would leave him.
He didn't want her to leave him either.
They weren't married.
No, they weren't married. Picasso never divorced his first wife, Olga. So Marie-Thérèse came after Olga and then Dorimar and then Françoise.
He told Françoise, "No one leaves a man like me."
And she said, "Watch me."
And with that, her career took off.
And he tried to actively sabotage her as well. You know, he tried to blackball her from Paris. And so she moved to London and had a gallery in London that she was very successful with.
And later came to America, which he had never conquered in person.
And the works that you have on exhibit, they're a virtual timeline of her career?
We do have works from the 1950s all the way to 2017. You will see a selection of the monotypes that range from 1989 to 2011, three different sessions during which she created these works. And we also have some of her most recent oil paintings. And in those, you will see a similar abstraction happening in a different medium. So you'll see the relationship between how she constructs her oil canvases and the compositions there and how she does it in the monotype medium. And you will also have a chance to see earlier drawings from the 1950s in which the abstract component is still present, but they're more figurative. So the monotypes really make a bridge between figurative work and abstraction.
They're very colorful works.
Oh, absolutely. She's a colorist at heart. You know, she always loved Matisse. They all read Goethe's theory of color, and she's very philosophical as well.
And artists of that generation were deeply trained, so they learned color theory. They learned the way our bodies respond physiologically to color, so she can use that power to affect an emotional reaction from us.
Almost like Rothko.
Do you find that there's some influence in her work from Picasso?
Oh, totally. I think that the modernists were all taking from each other, and that's why that movement was so impactful. I mean, it totally changed the canon of art history forever. But that was part of the beauty of why everything was so successful, was they were, you know, sharing philosophical ideas and ideas about art and experimenting with different things and, you know, it's like subtracting. They were using like minimal, you know, like when they're drawing, they took away everything that didn't need to be there and just left what could be implied to give a bull or a woman, you know.
Artists don't work in a vacuum. They need each other. They have dialogues with each other. Picasso himself was a tremendous thief, you could say.
Yeah, what was the famous thing? Good artists don't borrow, they steal. That's what he said.
But even so, she has said repeatedly that because of the closeness of the relationship, her tendency was to distance herself in her art. Perhaps if she had not been intimately involved in him, he would have had more influence over her creatively. But she was always more aesthetically drawn to and aligned with Matisse, who was another French artist with similar color sensibilities.
Mm-hmm. And she was younger, so she was hanging out with the new realists in Paris at the time, which is like Sonia Deloney, the Russian artist that came to Paris, you know, that does the beautiful abstracts in color.
But over and over, we see her determinedly setting her own course, having her own voice, not being overshadowed or absorbed into another being.
What does that say to today's young women? What is the message?
It's very inspiring. I mean, she is a feminist before feminism, really, but she would never call herself a feminist. She's just herself. But just, you know, the resilience and stay strong and believe in yourself.
It's quite an affirmation. She is a strong woman making strong artworks, and it is inspiring.
She did marry later on, and you can see an influence of science in her work. How is that?
Yes, she was married for 25 years to Dr. Jonas Salk, the pioneering polio vaccine scientist. And when you look at her abstract compositions, some people see cells dividing under a microscope or pathways of nerves and arteries. And you can also see the universe, the cosmos, the origin of everything. So I think she's looking at life on a macro and a micro level and inviting us to do the same.
McGrider Gallery co-founders Jill McGowey and Garland Grider, it's been a pleasure talking with you.
Thank you, Diane.
Thank you so much.
Françoise Gillot's Monotypes, Cartography of Hidden Worlds, is on view at McGrider Gallery, 615 Julia Street, through September 28th. You're listening to Inside the Arts on 89.9 WWNO, New Orleans Public Radio. I'm Diane Mack. This year's 50th Anniversary Jazz Fest was a major artistic success, despite the difficulties with the jinxed Rolling Stones turned to Fleetwood Mac bookings. From the opening bell to the second Sunday finale, artists across many genres turned in great set after great set. One of the best came from jazz vocalist and songwriter Gregory Porter. WWNO's Fred Kasten has this profile of the multi-talented artist who grew up in California.
Gregory Porter was born in Sacramento, spent early years in Los Angeles, moved to Bakersfield at 8, remained there through high school.
Gospel music was very important in my household. My mother was a minister, and there was a lot of singers in my family. It was a large family, 5 boys and 3 girls, so we were basically a choir. Mm-hmm. And but gospel music, you know, popular R&B and soul music, and my mother's records, which Mahalia Jackson, Nat King Cole, a lot of great music.
And musical experiences at church.
We grew up Church of God in Christ, and it was, so it's a very, you know, expressive music, emotional expressions are often in the music. And I started very young. I remember my first solo at 5, and, you know, wearing a white cape and a red bow tie.
Gregory Porter is an accomplished songwriter. And the church was also among the things that helped feed his early interest in language and writing.
Inspiration that can come from the biblical text is quite strong. And I also did some acting early on, junior high and high school. So I was also doing theater, so Shakespeare. And my mother loved poetry. And so we were reading a lot of poetry, you know, playing around with poetry, trying to figure out how to write it when we were young. But for me, I kind of always had a knack of putting words together. Mm-hmm. And it's just something that felt right for me. Both my mother, if you know, poetic talent can be inherited. Both my mother and father were poets. She used to write her poetry on little scraps of paper, and you know, on the back of cereal boxes, and all. She would write when it would come to her. If she was sitting in the car, if she was at the bank. So it was really just a part of our lives. You know, my mother would break off and start writing, and you know. Right. So when she passed away, there were all these little scraps of paper that we all, you know, we collected up, and you know, there's enough there for a book, but you know, it's just beautiful to have
these
bits of inspiration that came in a particular moment, and that's how I write my songs. I don't sit down at a desk and say, okay, now I'm going to write a song. At the point at which it strikes me, I grab a pencil or whatever instrument that I have, and I document, I put it down, and that's the way it works for me, like just like it did for my mother.
Well, they build their houses in preparation for the king, and they line the sidewalks with every sort of shiny thing.
I've been able to sell hundreds of thousands of records around the world, and those records contain in it things that I believe. You know, When Love Was King, I believe that. No Love Dying, I believe that. I mean, these are things I believe about life and feeling, that maybe, you know, some things that my mother has instilled in me. And I like the fact that who I am is in the music. I didn't have to change myself in order to have some success.
Well, they build their houses in preparation for the king, and they line the sidewalks with every sort of shiny thing. They will be surprised when they hear him say, take me to the alley, take me to the afflicted ones.
My mother said I used to sing myself to sleep when I was a baby. And, you know, I when I was a kid and as an adult even, I'd sing myself feel better just as I'm walking around the house or walking down the street. I did it in high school, and sometimes I would get in trouble, and people, you know, you need to be quiet in the hallways, and, you know. People sometimes thought I was trying to show off or be looked at, but really, this was my own thing, something that nobody can take away from me. This is the thing that I have inside of me that at any point I can let it out and make myself feel better. And I hope now that this is my career that I can open my mouth and sing, you know, the spirit and make somebody feel better, or make them think, or make them feel.
There was a boy, a very strange, enchanted boy. They say he wandered very far, very far, over land and sea. A little shy.
When I was an athlete in college and I injured myself and I wasn't able to play, or quite frankly, I wasn't even able to run without pain. So in that sense, I ceased to be an athlete. And my identity changed, and my like the stamp on my head that, you know, that people walk around with. Okay, you're a student athlete, you're an artist, you're a you know, whatever. my identity changed. And so in search of this new me, I started to fall back into my main love, which was music.
Bringing up big rocks on a chain gang. Bringing rocks and serving my time. Bringing rocks out here on a chain gang. 'Cause I've been convicted of crime. Hold it steady right there and let me hit it well. Well, I reckon that honor get it, yeah.
Gregory Porter got a final, very important word of advice from his mom.
She was at the end of her life, and, you know, she knew it. She knew it more than we did. We were trying to just let her know that she did a great job and not to worry about us, and we're going to do everything stable and normal and just, you know. She told me to be risky and to, you know, go for this, you know, this strange dream of being a singer. And she said, don't forget about your music.
Hundreds of thousands of recordings sold and scores of international performances at top venues and major festivals later, Gregory Porter has definitely not forgotten about his music. For 89.9 WWNO, I'm Fred Caston.
Well, they build their houses in preparation for the king, and they line the sidewalks with every sort of
Grammy-winning vocalist and songwriter Gregory Porter's most recent recording is 2018's One Night Only, live at the Royal Albert Hall. That's our show for this week. Major support for Inside the Arts comes from the Helles Foundation. Additional support comes from Christwood Retirement Community, the Contemporary Arts Center, and the New Orleans Opera Association. Our program is a production of WWNO and is archived at wwno.org. I'll be back with more ideas for your artistic palette on Tuesdays at 1 p.m., Wednesdays at 8:30 p.m., and a shortened edition on Thursday mornings at 8:45, when we'll go Inside the Arts. I'm Diane Mack.